This is Ask the Investigator, the podcast that navigates the high seas of professional investigation, gives the warning signs of when it's time to stop being your own Dick Tracy and call a professional, and offers tips on what to do before making that call to help your cause. Now, here's your host, Ken Cummins.
Hello, and welcome to another edition of Ask the Investigator. This week, we're going to be tackling the investigative technique of surveillance, and how a good surveillance can really make your day. Find the evidence, the clues that'll solve your case or your problems. But how it can also go south very quickly, and when you should not attempt to use this technique. And here, as always, to help me untangle that is my co-host, Christian Duvall. Hello, Christian.
Hello, everyone.
You ready to dive into the world of surveillance?
I am ready. It's a fascinating topic, and we have a lot of interesting stories for you.
Okay, great. But before we get into that, I have to introduce our other co-host, Tish Few, who's here every week. We couldn't do this program without this podcast without Tish. Could we, Tish?
I think you could, but it's okay. Thank you for the...
I don't think we could.
Really appreciate it. But I guess today we're talking about surveillance.
Yes.
This is going to be a good topic. We've got a great expert with us today, so I'm psyched to hear him in the second segment. But from your experience, Ken and Christian, what types of surveillance do you actually administer? Like, what do you do when you get out there and clients need you to surveil a suspect?
It's important to know the different types of surveillance, because you have physical surveillance, which could be following someone. You have electronic surveillance, which would be, for instance, CCTV or placing a GPS or doing legal wiretapping and so forth. And you have technical surveillance, which is technical surveillance countermeasure, TSCM, or you also have interviews that can be part of surveillance. And the one thing that we always have to be very careful for, especially in the world of surveillance, is you want to make sure that you're not doing the dirty work of a foreign government, for instance. They're asking you to follow somebody and do their dirty work. Or you also want to be very careful not to disclose live information to the person who hired you. You've heard stories about clients murdering the husband who the private investigator was following or compromising a situation. So it's a very sensitive field, and we have to be very careful with what we do, and we have to do it responsibly.
Right. And you left out drone surveillance, which is a rapidly emerging field, which we're not going to get into here, because we're going to deal this week with the traditional surveillance of following people on foot, following people on cars, when we do that, when we use surveillance, and when we don't. And like I said, things can go south quickly, and one of the things that we always encourage our clients say, well, when you do an intake for surveillance, I usually spend 45 minutes or more talking to them, to the client. It can be for domestic, to prove infidelity, or it could be for child support. And those are the common types of surveillance in people's minds. But surveillance is used in every, or can be used in every type of investigation. We can use it for business investigations, business intelligence, criminal defense, mergers and acquisitions, contract awards. I think we should give a few examples of that here. But for instance, we had a case where we had a client who was competing for a huge government contract. And all of these contract awards, they have a pre-bid meeting, a pre-bid conference. And so we set up across the street from where the pre-bid conference was and videotaped everybody going into the building, assuming that people going in groups of three or four or more were probably going in to attend this conference and get the information to calculate their bid. And then when we took that tape and we matched it up with photos of officials or employees of competitors, we were able to identify who the competition was going to be. And that's just an example of how this is used.
Well, what type of information did you get from your client in order to follow through with this type of surveillance?
We got very little information from the client. We got that there was going to be a pre-bid conference, and of course they were invited to it, so we knew where that was going to be, what time, and that was basically it. Then when we got the photos, they helped us identify some of the people or suggest, you know, where when we got the video, they helped us identify, well, you might look and see if this company, I think this company was there. And so we would look at the photos of those employees and identify them. That one, usually we have a lot more information now, but that was, that, you know, that was a, that was not a moving surveillance. That was a static surveillance. And we were collecting information. And so a lot of time, usually we try to get as much information out of the client as possible to help us out.
Christian, what's the difference between static and moving surveillance?
Well, there's, okay, so surveillance, and you'll watch in a lot of movies where you see the action and people jumping off, you know, the subway and taking a bike and following. Yeah, that, I mean, that's part of the surveillance, but surveillance also sitting around with not much going on. Surveillance can be also, and we've had that, especially in Washington, D.C., because you have a lot of security or counter-security bubbles, and law enforcement will make contact with you and say, what are you doing here? Or we've had neighbors call the police on us. So, you know, you'll have that will take place, or you'll face, for me, it's probably the most stressful type of investigation that I've had to do, because you'll have to improvise, constantly improvise. You're following someone with a car, and then all of a sudden the person hops out, is dropped off by a cab. Then the person might take the metro or might take a bike, and with all the different ways of transportation, you need to stay put and follow the person. So the surveillance can be very, it could be you in a van and staying put, and or it could be you walking around, running and so forth.
In general, though, what do you guys need from your clients in order to...
We need as much information as possible. I mean, information is key. And again, that's what, you know, a good investigator will do their homework, because if you don't get information, the client is going to spend a lot of money unnecessarily. You might have to, you know, you want to know what the routine of the individual, your target, is. You need to get as much information as possible. Otherwise, you are going to have to learn it yourself, and that's going to cost a lot of money. It's going to run a lot of hours.
We need photos.
Nice.
We need description of cars and tag numbers of cars that are going to be involved. We need locations where they think this individual or individuals we're targeting might go during the surveillance period. We need to know which associates they might be meeting with. So when they do meet with somebody, we can say, oh, yeah, that's just an aunt, or that's a sister. Right. Or we can say, oh, we don't know who this is, so we better get some video of that person, and so we can try to identify them. And then if we're trying to identify an associate who's come on the scene, then we got to watch that associate when he or she gets in a car so we can get a tag number, and that's a key piece of evidence in identification. So what I was talking about earlier, the biggest thing we need, not the biggest thing, but the most important thing, is we need a commitment of resources. Mm-hmm. You can't do this with limited resources. Christian was describing, you know, following somebody, and then they jump into a cab, and that's happened to us, where the clients only wanted to have one investigator. We're following this person through downtown. To a downtown area, all of a sudden they hail a cab, jump in the cab. Your car, the surveillance investigator's car, is blocks away, and there are no cabs around to catch up. And so right then and there, the surveillance failed.
Or you could be in a, you know, in the country. You could be in the, not in the scope of a city, and you have an investigator who's following someone in a car. If they're really good, they can, they won't stick out. But if they, after a while, this person who they're following, the target, might realize, oh, this car's been following me for a while. And eventually, yeah, the investigator is spotted. So low resources can definitely put us at risk.
Yeah, and the country, it reminds me of an incident we had years ago with an employee who thought he was the world's greatest investigator, and he wasn't. But anyway, we were following this woman for her husband, which is a very common type of surveillance. We didn't want, it's not my favorite at all, but it's a very common type of surveillance. So he was parked, you know, down the road quite a ways away. And she left early in the morning. It was dark, to go to the airport and get on a plane. And he starts driving, and then at some point he flips on his lights to seem like that he was always been behind her, you know. She got onto it right away. When she landed in Seattle, she told her boyfriend, who was a cop, her lover, she thought she was being followed. And we had hired a crew on the ground there. He scoped out who the crew was. They got into a fight. They all got arrested. They're in the back of the car, and the police arresting officer runs all the information on this guy, so we get all everything we needed to know, but in a very roundabout way.
Well, this is good. You know, after the break, we're going to come back and speak with Tom, who's an expert also in surveillance, and get a little bit deeper into this topic.
And I will say Tom is half of the best surveillance team that ever worked for me.
Support for Ask the Investigator comes from Capital Inquiry, a full-service private investigations firm in business for more than 27 years. Whatever your investigative needs, Capital Inquiry can meet them. Whatever your investigative problems, Capital Inquiry will find a solution. Wherever you need investigative help around the world, Capital Inquiry's experienced team can be there. If you, your business, or law firm is facing a difficult problem, contact Capital Inquiry by calling 800-530-0766 or email info@capinq.com. All right, we're back. And Ken, can you introduce Tom, one of the best surveillance teams you've ever worked with?
Right. Joining us now at the mic is Tom Brown. I'm not going to say if that's an alias or his real name. He can say that. It sounds like an alias. But he and Frank Hoover used to do a lot of surveillance for me, and they're a very good team. You know, in a surveillance team, you need two things. You need people who can follow the target and not lose them, but at the same time, you need surveillance guys who can get the video, who can get the photograph, who can get that moment when it happens that you need. And it's very hard to find both of those qualities in one individual. And both Tom and Frank have those. And they have done some great work for me and come up with some great video that we'll talk about in a minute that solved cases and saved our clients lots of money in legal fees. But welcome, Tom.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
Now, you heard us talking in the beginning. Is there anything you want to add to or correct on what we said?
Nothing really to correct. I mean, as far as surveillance is concerned, it can make or break a case. Sometimes, depending upon what you gather, it may hurt. In other words, if you're hired to observe, and it has to be put this way because you have to remain objective. You don't care whether somebody does one thing or another, it does not matter to you, because ultimately you're going to testify in court. You're a professional witness. That's what you are. If you get any video, it will corroborate your testimony, because first you're going to testify. Then you will bring, if they need it, bring the video forward, and then they'll observe it, and it'll corroborate exactly what your testimony is.
Is that the way it works? Because I always thought I've testified, but not as a surveillance agent. I learned very early on in my career that I would be the worst surveillance investigator out there, so I quickly brought in experts like Tom. But my impression was that in court, in order to get that surveillance tape in, you had to be brought to the stand first to verify it.
You're brought to the stand. First of all, you're sworn in when they have everybody rise that is involved with the case of so-and-so versus so-and-so. Everybody rises, and everybody is included in with that case, that particular case, so the judge is overseeing at that time. You also have to go through the process of anything, videotapes, anything that you have that you've gathered, you've got to bring it in through security, and then it's brought up by probably one of the deputies, brought up into the courtroom. So it's actually up to the lawyers whether they want to lead with that video or not, but usually the way that it would work was that the investigator would come up and testify, and then they would, certainly your side's lawyer would say, and do you have video to corroborate your testimony? Yes, I do. Now here's where objections start coming in. Maybe the other side says, no, we don't want to see that, whatever. Sometimes they do a little timeout, and the lawyers want to go talk in the back, because the opposing lawyer is going to look at their client and say, what have you not told me?
Right.
Remember, you need to tell me everything, and then all of a sudden, they have a come-to-God moment.
Yeah. Yeah, no, we had a case not too long ago where an employee of the Metrorail system in Washington, D.C. was hurt, was allegedly hurt in an accident. He was the farthest one away from the impact, and he would show up for depositions or in court, and he'd shuffle, he'd move really slow, he'd talk really slow, he'd stutter, and he was claiming that he had physical injuries and he couldn't form his thoughts. And then Frank, in this case, we followed him, and he was very, very difficult to follow. He would leave his house, he would circle his block two times before he'd actually take off, and then when he got to the end of the alley, he would go left, even though it was a one-way street, he would go the wrong way. And so we decided we'll just catch him at a point where we know he's got to be. And this is very important in surveillance. You got to have some place to start or some place, you know the person's going to be. And we knew he dropped his son off at school. So we got videotape of him running up and down the steps to the school and skipping down the sidewalk, and then we sent in a female investigator, and she had a conversation which she recorded because it was in the District of Columbia, and D.C. is a one-party consent state. As long as one person knows the conversation is being recorded, it's legal. So when they brought this videotape up in conference, arbitration or conference hearing, and they showed it to the lawyers, the case settled that day. So you're right. It can settle very quickly once they see what you got, and that was a powerful piece of evidence.
So if you are actually asked to testify, what type of questions do they ask you?
Well, first they're going to ask about your background. Are you qualified? They're going to establish that. Once they've gotten that out of the way, do you have your license? Because they can get you on technicalities. If you're private investigation, let's say, for example, this was a court case in Virginia, they need to make sure you have a valid one. If you do not have a valid PI registration, guess what? All your testimony is gone.
Wow.
It's thrown out. They won't even hear it. The judge won't hear it. And you need to be ready, be prepared for court. That means that you have mock court in your office. You start firing questions at each other. You go over your testimony just so, because you know that judges do not want to spend all day listening to this stuff. They need to hear the highlight reel, the bullet point. Get to it. This is what I want to hear. And I don't want you to describe like he rubbed her back in a loving way or anything like that. I observed this individual place his hand in the small of the back of this other individual and move his hand up and down slightly. And if you have video of it, you let them interpret it. Don't interpret it yourself. Once you start testifying and it looks like you're kind of adding a little bit into it, they're going to throw it all out. It has to remain absolutely objective, and that's the way you present it. Because you don't care, and you can tell the client, I don't care what the other person does. They might not like hearing that, but that is actually the best mindset to have prior to testifying. But you also need to memorize every day that you worked. Don't come up with notes, because if they see that, now this is something that can be worked against you. Okay, opposing attorney sees you with notes and say, are you not familiar with the case that you worked? Why do you need notes? Yeah. So what they're trying to do is inflict doubt now into the mind of the judge.
And trying to trip you up.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Well, have you ever had any situations in court where you screwed up, so to speak?
I know for a fact that Frank did. He lost his temper one time. And actually, it was actually the fault of the judge because of the way that the opposing attorney was badgering him, let it go. And also, to be honest, the attorney for our client was letting it go, not objecting. It was getting ridiculous. And Frank lost his temper a little bit and yelled. But he didn't, no profanities or anything like that. But I think one time actually, and it's really the only time I can think of, where the attorney did not get with us to talk about our testimony prior to court. There was a problem with the exact days that we worked. We know what days we worked. The attorney was wrong. They said, did you have an occasion to work this particular case on whatever November 18th? And I said, no, I did not. And he looked at me surprised.
So that was an attorney who came to court unprepared.
Unprepared because it was the 19th, not the 18th. You've got it. You've got to be accurate. And you know what? That lawyer failed his client.
Wow.
He tried to throw it all on us. And then when we got outside in the hallway and this guy tried to holler at me, I gave it right back to him. I said, you don't even know what day that we worked? Come on, bud.
Right.
And you didn't say no, not that date. This date, is that keeping the emotion
out of it? I tried to lead him as much as I could, but he kept going back. And you know what? By that point, he started treating me as if I were a hostile witness. I was hired by you.
Right. Yeah.
And we got outside, and I said, this is horrible. I say, you need to go back to law school or something like that. This is pretty bad. You failed your client. And I said, and I told you we needed to meet prior to iron everything out, at least get the details down of the exact dates and the times that we worked. But no, you didn't want to do that. You said you didn't have time. Well, that means you didn't have enough time for your client. That's the bottom line.
Right.
And they failed.
Let's talk a little bit about intake. We were talking about all the information you got to get, but also the pre-surveillance prep is very important in this, especially when you're going into neighborhoods you're not familiar with.
That's true. Well, the first thing you got to worry about is get the addresses, know the area. You know, recon using digital media if you can, you know, recon the area as much as possible without having to even go into it. You find out what you can, then you've got to prep your vehicle. You got to have a full tank of gas. You got to have the right kind of vehicle that's going to fit into that neighborhood, know that kind of neighborhood. If you go to Great Falls, Virginia, okay, you don't want to be driving around in what we call a beater. You know, it's going to stand out, right? But you also don't want, like, a Range Rover, you know, in a part of town where nobody drives a Range Rover either. So you have to have, if you can, get a neutral color car that's not too old, but it's not necessarily shiny brand new, and also prep it in the rear so you can be discreet. You can maybe hop into the back seat. You can shoot film out of it. It's got a full tank of gas. You've got plenty of water. You've got some snacks, but you've got binding foods. You need to think about the bathroom issue, okay? And going number one, you know, without getting too graphic here, going number one is a lot easier than going number two. So you prep by actually what you eat the prior day, and you eat binding foods. You have water. You also have empty bottles for the exit, you know, and you have as much information as you can get about the subject that you're following, the neighborhood that they're in, the clothing that you have in the vehicle. You got to have everything from sweats to suits, tennis shoes, flip-flops, dress shoes. You've got to be prepared for everything. And I followed a guy who was supposed to go. He was in the medical field. He was supposed to go to Richmond. He came out of Northern Virginia, supposed to go to Richmond for a medical conference of some kind. He ended up going opposite direction and went up north to a borough right outside of Philadelphia. And I was dressed up to go into the conference with him. Well, I had to dress down when I got into this little borough because I did not fit in wearing a suit or anything like that. He ended up going to a house, and then he stayed in that house for two solid days. I had to sit on that house for two solid days. And without a break. Again, somebody only paying for one investigator. What are you going to do? But I stayed awake.
And you had to follow him with one investigator from Richmond to, or right, from Northern Virginia to Philadelphia?
Yeah.
That's not easy.
No, it's not. Because you need to, the way that Frank and I were trained, and this is interesting, you end up learning on the job from previous private investigators, their tactics and stuff like that. But our old boss said, here's the deal. If you get burned, you don't get paid. If you lose them, you don't get paid. Now, this is illegal, right? But that's the way it was back then. That's the way this guy operated. And he was mean, but it taught us. And the people that joined this firm, if you couldn't, it was sink or swim. Either you made it happen. You could sit on a house for 8 hours. A person leaves, you lose them at the first traffic light. You don't get paid for that day.
Yeah.
That's just the way it works. Yeah. It's a great motivator, really, when you think about it, to think about everything. You run across every scenario in your mind. Where are all the traffic lights around here? What time of day is it? If they're leaving at this time of day, is it toward dinner hours? You know, then you start thinking about the restaurants that are nearby. Everything. You're always thinking ahead, constantly running scenarios through your head.
Right.
So you're not surprised.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the fact that there are times when you should not consent to your client's effort or wish to use to conduct surveillance because they're not willing to commit enough resources that allows you to have put the manpower and the number of investigators in the field that's going to guarantee success. When you're out there with one investigator, one surveillance investigator, I always tell people that your chances of getting what you're looking for are going to be about 50-50. You put two skilled investigators out there who have worked, particularly two have worked together before, it goes up to 80 or 90%. Would you agree with that?
100%. When you're working a case and you have an additional person, a good one at that, it helps so much. But when you're talking to the client, say, look, if you're going to hire me to do the cabinets in your kitchen, don't give me one hammer and just a couple nails. Allow me to have the tools to satisfy what you want to get done. Because, let's say, for example, we're following somebody that works at the State Department. Okay, there are multiple ways out of the State Department. And you need multiple people. You can't get close to the State Department because right. of their security. You need to back off and create a bubble. That way, it's basically like a visual tripwire yeah. around that general area. And when they break the beam with their known vehicle, you can confirm the tag. They broke the beam, the other people can collapse the bubble and start rolling with when you go mobile
right.
from there. But you need multiple bodies to do it. You've got to have the right resources right.
Now,
to do it.
Christian has had some episodes, experience with trying to do surveillance around embassies. Remember those?
Mm. Oh, yeah. Well, like I said, at the beginning, we had Secret Service. And to be honest, we warned United States Secret Service that we were going to conduct a surveillance in the vicinity to an embassy. I think was it with you, Tom, or I might be wrong, but we warned them, and they said, well, sorry, we understand, but if we get a call, we still have to respond. So, and the problem with law enforcement, when they make contact with you, and that's something that happened to us at an airport, it can lead you to lose your target
right.
because you have to answer to them first, and you cannot just run from them. So it gets very, very complex. And that day, we had the Secret Service make contact with us. And, fortunately, the target was still inside the house, the place of residence, but it can be very complex. We had another situation where we're watching a kid who was going to go to juvenile rehab, and we had to make sure the kid was not going to escape. And that day, the neighbors called the police on us, and again, we had to deal with it. So it can get very tricky.
How do you deal with that? Like, what do you generally say?
Well, first of all, I'm going to tell you the first thing you're going to do, you're going to show your private investigator license. And that's the first thing you want to do is going to establish an instantaneous credibility. They're going to question you. I've had law enforcement. Conducted surveillance right outside an airport, and the police station was right there. They actually took the license of their car. They, made sure that it was valid, and then I was on my way. But I always, they might ask questions, and we have to remember, we are bound by confidentiality,
right.
and we're not to, divulge
okay.
the name or the nature of our operation. So in very general term, officer, I'm conducting a surveillance. Here's my license. I'm accredited here and there. And usually that's good enough. And if they, persist, we've had a situation where, police officer persisted. We provided the number of the company, and I think the police officer never actually followed through. So that was good enough.
Is there a universal license, or is it per state?
No, per state. Per state.
Per state, right. Yeah. And some states will not recognize. Virginia, for instance, Tom was talking about this earlier. Virginia, the lawyers always had this technique that if you were an investigator, say, from the District of Columbia or from Maryland, and you get up to testify and say, Your Honor, the case started in D.C., I followed him out here. And then the defense attorney will say, well, where is your Virginia license? And so, oh, no, I'm licensed in D.C. It gets thrown out right away.
And
so you got to cover all those bases.
I will say, I believe that they recognize that issue, and they started going with wherever it originates from. And that's something that actually you would talk to not only client, but like their legal representative as well. And say, look, if we end up going to another state, everything's good to go, right? If it starts in Virginia, we end up gathering, we follow somebody to Alaska, Colorado, whatever it might be.
Right.
Everything's good to go, or do we need to hire someone local there? And
right.
it only counts when they gather it. You clear all that up. But I think now, as long as it originates somewhere and you have the PI license from the origin of that case for that state or the city of Washington, I think you're good to go now.
Yes, but it's always best not to take a chance.
I agree.
And so when you get in, if you're following somebody, you get on a plane, like I gave the example of the woman who flew to Seattle. Well, we made to meet her boyfriend. We made sure we had a Washington licensed crew at the airport. So you can put somebody on the plane, and I always think it's better to put your own guy on the plane and then have a crew on the ground waiting that he can work with and they can work with him, because you can't control these people. I've had too many cases. I had one in Las Vegas where I had instructed the crew to get out there at 7 a.m. They didn't start till 10. They said, and the guy said, oh, we know how this town works. We we know how this town works. We know people don't get up before 10. They stay out late. They don't get up before, you know, they don't get up at, before 10 o'clock. Well, the couple that we were watching had changed hotels at 8 o'clock that morning. And they would have gotten the video we needed if they had been there. But they knew better than we did.
So, Tom, I have a question about a surveillance sort of nightmare that you experienced where you were on a case and things went sour or were very complicated. Do you have such case?
Yeah.
you remember those.
Yeah, you do. They tend to stick out. And this is going to go into the relationship that you have with your client, the information that you get from your client, and did your client lie to you? If your client hired another firm previous to you and then something screwed up horribly, they got compromised, whatever it is, and then they go to a new firm. You know, they're not happy with that firm. They got blown out of the water. And they come to you and they say, I'd like to hire you to file my husband and my wife, whatever situation might be. We would ask, okay, have you hired someone before? Is this the first time you're doing it? Yeah, first time. Absolutely. Well, that was a lie. And so we would set up relatively discreetly in a neighborhood. And all of a sudden, we've got neighbors looking at us, like, immediately. And then we backed off. It's better to let them question themselves. We back off, and then we make a phone call. What's going on? And then finally, the client starts admitting, like, well, I did have this other company that tried to do it. Turned out there was a physical altercation out in front of the house. And, oh, really? Well, thanks for letting us know that.
You're right.
You know, kind of things will happen. And you can have nightmare clients. Your client needs to give you as much information as they can, but then also when you sign the agreement with the client, there's also something in there to protect yourself, that everything you gather and you turn over to your client, they're not going to take it and do something illegal with it.
Right.
Have you ever faced a very dangerous situation or where you felt that your life might be in danger?
Yeah, I worked some. Part of what we would do, we'd serve papers sometimes, and I had to serve some papers in Bladensburg.
Right.
And I got a shotgun pulled on me.
Yeah.
And the guy opened the main door, and he kept the screen door shut, and he had a shotgun pointed at me, and he said, I swear to God, if that has anything to do with my wife, you're dead. And I looked at it, and I said, sir, I think this has something to do with, like, you're a witness to a car accident. And he goes, oh, damn, I'm sorry, man. And he put the shotgun down. And at that time, you didn't have to physically touch somebody with a paper, but you had to make them aware. So I just said, well, here, it's for you. And I just folded it up and stuck it in between the screen and a little bit of wiring in the
right.
front. And I got out of Dodge quickly because, yes, it was from his wife. And, I sure heard my tires squealing when I was at. I'm glad the guy could read slow because I didn't hear a blast behind me. So,
something tells me you were pretty calm and face-to-face, and then you got in the car and was like,
well, at that point, I mean, if I'm staring, if it's going to happen, it's going to happen.
Yeah.
You know, there's nothing
I can
do.
It's kind of funny because service of process, and yes. For me as well, whenever I've conducted surveillances, and I've gone to Mexico, I've gone to prison, I've, you know, been dangerous, what you would think were dangerous situations, but the most dangerous situations I've ever been in have been service of process. It's really interesting.
That's right.
It's just somebody trying to avoid at any cost to be served papers. It's very interesting.
Yeah. It's also the thing that these law firms want to pay the least for. And without it, we're getting off target here, but
right.
Without the service, the case doesn't go forward. And a lot of times we do surveillance in order to be able to serve somebody.
Besides, we've talked about a couple of cases here, but what type of domestic cases do you typically work with?
That would deal with adultery. You've got child custody, and maybe somebody challenging an already existing custody arrangement. Maybe the father or the wife wants more time with that child, so you are hired to follow them. That when they give visitation with the child, does it appear that openly that they are spending quality time with the child, or are they dumping the child off on a friend, and they're just actually using the kid as just a weapon against their ex? And that does happen. You've got that. You've got protective things, child abuse cases. Normally, someone's not going to do something out in public to their child. It's almost like following somebody who's a drug user. They don't do it out in the open. But people who abuse children, sometimes they'll lose it out in front. With the first company I started with, there was a suspicion that this guy, when he would get visitation, when the child would come back to the mother, there were bruises on the child. And so we followed the guy. He lived near Fort McNair in D.C., and he was going out of town with his child. He picked up a child, and they were northbound, and pulled off at a rest stop in Pennsylvania. And something happened. There was a spill of some kind inside the vehicle because the dad gets out, stomps around to the passenger side, yanks the kid out, and I thought the kid's arm got torn out of the socket, like dislocated. The kid started screaming, and the guy was holding the kid up in the air by his arm. This would have been about maybe a 5 or 6 year old, and then he started wiping, like it looked like a spilled soda or something like that, out of the seat. And then he started, he grabbed the kid's shoulders, bent down, and started screaming and shaking him back and forth. I called 911 and got the troopers on him. You can try to prove something, but when you see something happening and you know that now the game has changed, law enforcement, or maybe it might be medical services, whatever the situation might be, it changes. You need to do it. You have an obligation as a human being, as a citizen, that there are some things that supersede what you're hired to do.
Right.
And at that point, called 911.
Of course, that also strengthened your case, or the client's case.
It certainly did, and I think it was done. She didn't need us after that. But at that point, you know, I thought that there might be a chance that the guy might leave before the troopers got there, so I pulled in my vehicle behind his, and I blocked it.
Oh, wow.
And when he came around to talk to me, I just didn't answer him. I kept my window rolled up and just didn't answer him, and the trooper got there pretty quick time.
Now, on these domestic cases or infidelity cases, which are not as common as they used to be because we have a lot of no-fault divorce states, but the two key pieces of evidence are public display of affection and opportunity, spending the night somewhere.
Right.
And so we have a lot of – so you need both of those, and that – public display of affection is one of the harder things to get because a lot of times they're trying to be very cautious about what they do in public.
That's right. Yeah, they're difficult. If two people spend the night together in a residence, well, what are the things that you have to prove? That they were by themselves. Okay, so you wait, you get film of both of them leaving, and then afterwards we'd have to set up our cameras on the front door, and we'd go up to the door, and we'd pound on the door and wait, pound on the door and wait. And when nobody answered, you could satisfy that there was nobody else in there. And if you sat on that residence all night long, you prove that they were together all night long. Now, they might be friends. Okay, we need to be objective about this, or the other side's going to argue that. So now we need to prove what is the status of their relationship with each other. What is it? That's the public display of affection. And yeah, you got to spend some time on it, but sooner or later, you know,
it happens.
It is going to happen, and you've got to be there. You got to be ready to snap up the camera quickly.
So when it comes to, like, juicy cases, that's probably where the ears perk up. And I guess one of my questions is, what if the person's not guilty and their partner persists to say, I know something's happening, you got to find it? Like, how do you handle that?
It does happen. And I think from the onset, if you talk to your client the right way, you just say, we will observe his or her actions, and whatever happens, happens. If there is something going on, we will most likely get it. For the times that you okay us to start working, you know, you will establish when we start and when we end, and we will see what happens. But if nothing happens, does that mean that the person's not doing anything? No.
No.
It's just under our watch, nothing did occur.
That means the client still has to pay.
And
that's
and
what that means.
That road also goes with the insurance fraud stuff. Following somebody, it was like about 80% of the people were fudging what they were doing, like over-exaggerating. And I got to believe, I'm going to be honest here, that lawyers were behind it. Like if a guy says, look, I mean, my hand is tingling. Like, no, you can't move your hand. That's what the lawyer says. Okay?
Right.
You start from somewhere so that when they reach a settlement, it's still good. Yeah. I've followed a guy who there was a botched surgery on his hand, and he said he couldn't move. He was also in pain, and the nerves ran up his shoulder and everything like that. And actually, half the time, he was in a wheelchair. And you know what? After following the guy, it was absolutely legitimate. This guy was messed up. He was always on medication. He was in a wheelchair. He rolled out the back sliding glass door, and he had a blanket over him. He could barely move, and he was operating it with one hand, and he had bars running through his left hand, and he fell asleep because of the medication that he was on, and then it started snowing. So I had to call medical services. I'm not going to sit there and watch a guy go into hypothermia. This guy was absolutely legit. And I got to say that when it's the claims are 100% accurate, it's rare. Because usually there are over-exaggerations or it's a flat-out
right.
lie. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we had one of those where, the insurance companies are always, they're always convinced that the person on disability is faking. So he was going to attend his granddaughter's wedding, and so the insurance company was convinced he'll dance with his granddaughter at the wedding, one of the dances where you have the father, you have all the family dancing. So they paid for two people to attend the wedding, be in the hotel where the wedding was, and to be able to slip into the reception. And so it got to that point where it came time to dance, and team was all set up, had the cameras rolling, and the guy came out there with just his cane, with a cane, and he just hugged her but didn't dance. And so they, he wasn't faking. And mm-hmm. a lot of times they are faking, but there are times when they're not.
And we even had a police officer we had to follow once for an investigation, a workers' comp investigation, and unfortunately, he was not saying the truth.
Right.
I'm lifting a mattress.
Right. I want to say one thing about, public display of affection. We had an unusual case where the husband was flying around the country attending conferences, and he would get a ticket for his escort from Las Vegas to come join him. And we had him in the same hotel room together. We had a picture, video of the interior of the hotel room to show the bed and the setup. But when they were out in public, it was strictly business. And it was so much so that, you became convinced this is just a business relationship. There's no affection between these two. There never will be. It's just somebody he wants to sleep with when he's away from his wife.
Wow. Okay, that's a lot. It's a good one to end on. Well, Tom, thank you so much for joining us today.
Absolutely.
We really appreciate your time. And
thank you.
We'll be back after this word from our sponsor. Ken, why would an individual company or a legal team hire Capital Inquiry for surveillance work?
Well, you just witnessed the caliber of our surveillance team with Tom Brown here. We have a very good, a very experienced surveillance team. I learned long ago that you don't hire investigators and try to train them to be surveillance guys. You hire people who want to do this this type of investigation and only this type of investigation, and are doing it every day and all the time. And they're the ones that know how to do it. They're the ones that are going to get the evidence you need. They're not going to lose their quarry, and you're not going to end up spending a lot of money for no results. So the client gets what they want, the clients get what they want, and we get what we want, which is business.
If you, your business, or law firm is facing a difficult problem, contact Capital Inquiry by calling 800-530-0766 or email info@capinq.com. We are back. So Ken, that was a pretty good, impactful second segment. I think Tom is obviously an extremely good professional, and sounds like you've had the best working with you.
We have. And so now we want to get into lessons learned from this. And of course, Tom didn't say this. I was hoping he'd say it, because he has this expression, when we talk about you don't want to get out there if you just have limited resources and you only can do it for 4 or 5 hours. You really don't want to waste your money on surveillance. You want to try to figure out another way to do it, which is what we always try to do. But Tom's expression is you don't want to bring a knife to a gunfight. If you got an important case, you've got to be willing to commit the number of investigators and the amount of resources needed to get the job done. Now, Christian, what did we learn from this?
Well, we've learned certainly a lot. And one of the many traits Tom has is ethics and integrity. And I think that speaks very highly of how he works. It's preparation. It's knowing what you're getting into, identifying the entry exit points, being prepared, having the right props, I think all of these are very, very important. And if you omit or don't do one, follow one of these, you can a case can go the wrong way very quickly. That's what I would say.
You got any last anecdotes you want to relate here before we sign off?
Well, I there's a misconception with surveillance. A lot of people think it's mostly domestic, but it's so many different things.
That's
We've done a funeral home where we had to substantiate that they were treating corpses the right way. Or we had a construction site where a construction worker was trying to vandalize the equipment because he hadn't gotten paid. Or we've had, like I said, the child going to rehab. Or we've had fraud investigations. So we've conducted surveillance for so many different areas. And it's very, very interesting.
Right. We've had a lot of non-competes where an executive leaves a company and he has a non-compete agreement with the firm he left, and he's secretly working for another company.
We actually had one where the wife wanted to wanted proof that the husband did cocaine, and that's something we decided not to do, but they wanted us to go to her to his place of residence and offer cocaine and see if he would accept it. And videotape it. That's right.
That's where the ethics comes in.
That's correct.
And that's what you've got to be known in this industry. You've got to be known for your professionalism and your ethics. Otherwise, you're not going to get any business, and you're not going to last very long.
We also had a case about a lady who had mental problems, and she said that she heard voices, and she wanted to be surveilled and videotaped throughout the day so that we could prove that there was no one talking to her, and so that she could see it. So they can get very interesting.
Right.
Excellent. So, Ken, do we have any more bonus episodes for this summer?
Yes, we're doing one. We're going to do one more for the summer in July, and I'm not going to announce the topic here because we're debating between two topics, and it depends on which guest is available.
Okay.
But you'll hear us again soon.
Well, you can help that process move along. If you have any questions or comments or topics you would like us to consider, please reach out to us at askinvestigator@gmail.com. Or follow us on Twitter at #AskInvestigator, and thank you.
And we want to thank Bomas Prindon, our band.
You've been listening to Ask the Investigator. Send your comments, questions, and suggestions to askinvestigator@gmail.com and follow us on Twitter at #AskInvestigator. Thanks for tuning in.